Welcome back to The Feminist Agenda, a podcast that will explore what it means to be a professional feminist, how to bring feminism into your work no matter what you do, and we'll talk about how to keep our agendas organized. I'm your host, Veronica, and we are still in the midst of the coronavirus pandemic at the start of the fall semester. So apologies for being late with this episode as a one-woman shop. That's going to happen a lot. So, as I write the script and edit this episode, we're wrapping up the Democratic National Party convention. And as much as I'm pissed off about a lot of things, especially in the realm of electoral politics, these conventions usually do pull at my heartstrings. I joke that I have a cold heart, but really I'm a big sap. I cried throughout Hillary Clinton's speech, not because I miss her, as much as I admire the strength to lose against Trump, have to continue being a stateswoman, and keep it all in check. I have zero chill, friends. If I'm pissed at you, you probably know it just by looking at me. I saw someone on Twitter say something like, she has so much strength to not just sit back with a drink and say, I told you, bitches, and do the Jennifer Love Hewitt, I know what you did last summer hand thing. Speaking of Twitter, I noticed that just behind Elizabeth Warren's shoulder on a bookshelf were the letters BLM in the classroom she was speaking from. I tweeted out a picture and got a zillion retweets. RIP my mentions. I, of course, then plugged this podcast, so if you're here because of that tweet, welcome. It is frustrating to listen to professionally done videos highlighting the atrocities the Trump administration has committed when we know that maybe not at the level, but similar things have happened under Presidents Clinton and Obama. So this, it is hard to get too excited when, as the daughter of a Mexican immigrant, I have heard about new immigration policies coming for 3 decades. It is also frustrating to see people like Kasich and Powell, who helped get us to this moment, Powell who helped start a war, have time, given time, to make a case for Biden. I believe in the power of elections. I am out getting out the vote almost every election cycle, working for candidates. But I know we can't elect our saviors. We have to save ourselves. And often that looks like a riot. So I ask you to talk with BIPOC folk in your town or neighborhood before you judge anything the authorities call a riot. A lot of these incidences are not good or bad, but nuanced. Start to learn how to be uncomfortable with that nuance. Peel back the layers. Remember that the late John Lewis was not always seen as a civil rights hero. Today's historic figures are likely to be described as troublemakers. So, in this episode, I sit down with a historian whose new book looks back at the feminism of the 90s. And yes, as I said in the last episode, I'm in this book. This is actually part one of our conversation. The second part will have the chairs flipped. But until then, let's get into They Didn't See Us Coming, The Hidden History of Feminism in the 90s. Hi, Lisa. Thanks for joining me on The Feminist Agenda. Can you please introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about what you do?
Certainly. Thanks so much for having me, Veronica. I am the Director of Women's Gender and Sexuality Studies at the University of North Carolina, Greensboro, where I'm also Associate Professor in the History Department. And so, what my job entails is I teach courses in women's gender and sexuality studies, and I oversee the major and the minor. I coordinate the campus programming on feminism, and I work with faculty from around the university who are interested in research and teaching on gender, and also advocate for feminist change within the university as a whole.
Awesome. So we're talking, we got together because you reached, I don't exactly remember how we got connected, but I think you reached out to me because you were doing research for a book that just came out earlier this week called They Didn't See Us Coming, The Hidden History of Feminism in the 90s. So what prompted this book?
Yeah, Well, you know, I've spent my whole career trying to understand social movements beyond the famous leaders and kind of celebrated instances of mass protests. And so my research has always centered women of color and working class people, people who don't fit the kind of stereotype of who is an activist. So when I came across an article about the Beijing Women's Conference of 1995 that listed all of these women of color organizations that attended the conference, it gave me pause. I had known about this conference, but really only from the press coverage of it, which focused on Hillary Clinton, who was first lady at the time, and she gave a really celebrated speech at the conference where she declared women's rights are human rights. And that was kind of what most of us living in the States at that time learned about what happened in Beijing. I hadn't known that so many women from the United States attended the conference, and particularly so many women of color. And when I read this list of organizations, I didn't even recognize many of the organizations. And I was a feminist in the 90s, and I was teaching about the history of women and history of feminism. That was my job at the time when I came across this article maybe 10 years ago. So that I started digging into the story of these organizations and the people who were associated and with them and the broader story really of feminism during that decade.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, when the Beijing conference happened, I was an undergraduate and I remember hearing about it, and I feel like I think when the Beijing conference happened, or just before it happened, I was probably in my first real women's studies course. And I'm pretty sure that my faculty member knew somebody who had gone or was going, and just was fascinated by the whole thing. And yes, I agree. Most of the feedback or report out that we all got was really very centered around Hillary Clinton.
Yeah, it turned out that over 30,000 feminists from around the world were at this conference, right? Doing all kinds of things, making all kinds of connections, doing all kinds of activism. And yet that story was almost completely overlooked by the media, which I think is so indicative of the way the media in general covered the movement.
Yeah, I mean, the title of the book is They Didn't See Us Coming. And I know that in the 90s, it was very frustrating being a young feminist activist, because it was the time of Time magazine, essentially writing the obituary for feminism. And that was, it seemed like once a year, some media outlet was writing the obituary for feminism. And yet there I was, really discovering feminism in this kind of movement way, learning the language, the terminology, and how to craft a feminist framework that would help drive my life, my career, my parenting. And it was really frustrating. I just go back to that idea. And I think that's where I found a lot of community as well, other young feminists who were frustrated over this message that feminism was over.
Yeah, the cover, the Time magazine article that you're describing, the cover said, "Is feminism dead?" And then the article inside, basically the answer was yes, it is. You know, it's just this kind of frivolous thing, and those who are involved, you know, are just kind of individualist power seekers. And it really had so little to do with anything that I had seen or anything that I came across in my research. It was really quite amazing.
Absolutely. And the reason I say my first real women's studies class is because the first time I took a class that counted towards my women's studies minor, actually wasn't a women's studies class. It was an honors college course that was taught by someone from the women's studies department. Mm-hmm. And so when she talked me into joining the department, she was like, "We can count this class. You've done enough feminist work." And I was like, "Great."
So that was a lot of my introduction to like feminist theory, women's studies curriculum, gender studies. And this podcast is focused on feminists who are working in spaces that aren't thought of as feminist. And you're clearly doing feminist work, very traditional, like feminist professor, which under women's studies professor. But when you were doing the research and talking to other feminists from the 90s, who was doing work that really surprised you the most?
Such a great question. I was blown away by the network of feminists who were working through churches. So, as a historian, I knew that churches had been the center of the civil rights movement and also key players in, actually, a very unknown story, but key players in referring women who needed abortions to safe providers in before Roe v. Wade made abortion slightly more accessible. Yet I still didn't really expect to find women in churches at the center of some of the most incredible anti-racist feminist economic justice activism happening in the 1990s. But much of this work was transnational, which makes sense when you think about it. Churches have a really global reach. And the women I studied who were working through them made all these kinds of connections with women in the global South. And women in the global South at this time were really on the cutting edge of thinking critically about the effects of the rise of global capitalism and neoliberalism and privatization and the decimation of the social safety net and how all of these like huge things that were happening in the world were disproportionately affecting women and people of color. And the US women who worked with these and worked with and learned from these activists in other countries then took that knowledge home, really, and brought it to their churches, you know, like huge networks of women where they did all kinds of popular education, really creative work of role plays and, you know, doing kinds of creative exercises to have people really understand economic justice and what was happening in the world around them, why inequality was increasing so quickly, why women and people of color were suffering the most. It was really some incredible and very inspiring work that I learned about in a very unexpected place.
Yes, absolutely. One of my favorite professors in undergrad did her work was centered on feminism in the church. And I really went into that class. It wasn't about religion, but she definitely lifted up that theme within the class. And I remember just kind of like going in there and butting heads with her and coming out of it with a much better respect of what you just said, of the role of feminism within certain religious spaces and the power, the reach, and the impact that it does have. So there's just so many places in this book that really had me shaking my head, be like, yes, not even just remembering living through some of it, but just how thinking for a moment that this is a book about the 90s and so it's a history book in 2020, and how much of it is still so relevant, and the how unfortunate that is, but also affirming at the same time, particularly some of the tensions that have happened around the professionalization of feminism. So in you really drive this home when you're talking about domestic violence and the work around reducing domestic violence and giving the move towards smaller government and the privatization of the state, was the co do you think the co-optation of the domestic violence movement inevitable?
Such a hard question, Veronica. I mean, you're right that one of the main, I mean, one of the most it was one of the things I found in my research that once I figured it out, it was like, oh, of course, but it still, I felt needed to be said. I have a whole chapter on it, is that much of the work of feminism in the 90s, the reason Time magazine maybe thought the movement was dead was that it was happening not necessarily on the streets, but through institutions and nonprofits, by people who were being paid for their work. And so domestic violence is a really wonderful example of both like what was gained and what was lost in that transformation. Because when feminists organized around domestic violence in the 1970s, they came up with this idea of shelters, right? But that was often like an old house that someone happened to gain access to, or even someone's living room couch, right? That was the idea of like sheltering people, protecting them. It was very, very grassroots. But then the government, when the government started to fund this kind of service and started to fund these shelters, on the one hand, well, clearly something was gained because people were able to get full-time jobs doing this work. They were able to serve many more women than they had been in the past. They expanded their reach. But with that government involvement also came a tremendous reliance on the government for the money and involvement with many other aspects of the state, particularly the legal system, the police and the courts, institutions that women of color in particular did not trust and warned against getting involved in, as they continue to do today. And yet many of the white feminists who were involved in this work kind of struck that bargain, right? They said, we need the money. And so we can work with the police. We can do trainings for the police and make them more sensitive. And we can get these cases through the court. And they had a kind of optimism about working with the police that I think you can only probably have if you're a white woman, right, at this time, and thought that it was worth it to kind of make these sacrifices to get the money. So that's the bargain that they struck, and many still continue to strike today.
Absolutely. I like how you say that is the bargain, and this optimism that came with moving something that was very grassroots and very, you had to know the right person. Thinking about shelters, thinking about here in Chicago, we had Jane, the underground abortion network. You know, you had to know the right person or find the right flyer in order to be connected. And then elevating networks like domestic violence shelters to a government level means that there's now a city hotline. Unfortunately, it's not funded at the level that the needs are. The needs demand, but it is something to consider. So we've all been home for weeks and weeks and weeks and months during this pandemic, and it has given us, I think, I like to think that this pandemic gave us this moment of pause so that we could consider this current uprising for racial justice in a way that we never considered before, and has elevated conversations around carceral feminism, feminists who do believe in the state and police and incarceration as a way to make this world safer, with abolitionist feminists. But what this pandemic has also done is really reveal the weakness of our structure here in the United States, of our society, in terms of how we operate. I think that it's safe to say feminists have been saying this for years, if not for decades, that the United States economy is fueled by care work that's done at home. Care work that is done in institutions like nursing homes and daycares, but is undervalued and underpaid. And without it, our economy could collapse. And we're starting to see those fissures now that parents have to be at home, care for their children. And now schools are starting to ramp up for the fall. here in Chicago. They just said that all juniors and seniors are going to be virtual. And kids, other students are going to be going a couple days a week. And it just seems to be a patchwork from district to district. So I'd really love your thoughts on like how this pandemic, as awful as it is revealing what some of us have been talking about for decades.
I really couldn't say it better than you just did. It's like what we have been saying for decades about truly the horrors of modern free market US style capitalism are just coming out of the woodwork in such a clear way that we are we're collapsing into ourselves, right? And the childcare crisis is really one of many examples. And there are really many elements to the childcare crisis, as you pointed out. First is that we still do not as a culture value care or the labor done in a home, whether that's paid or unpaid. We don't recognize either its economic value or its human value, right? We just don't recognize its value. Second, before the pandemic hit, women were over half of the labor force, yet they were still disproportionately responsible for childcare and for household labor. And those two things are connected, right? The work is devalued because it's primarily women's work, whether it's women doing it unpaid in their own homes, or whether it's women who are paid to perform this work in our daycare centers, our nursing homes, in hospitals all over the country. Third, it seems very clear that we need a universal system of government-funded childcare, which is affordable for everyone, accessible for everyone, and pays its workers decent wages. We've made some progress in the pandemic, I feel, in emphasizing that it's not just the people who work in hospitals who are performing what we now call essential work. I think we've done the early days so many people were at home, became very clear, no, people in grocery stores, like that's essential work, right? There were these kind of other jobs that we integrated into our understanding of essential work, but we still, I don't think, have not done that with childcare, right? We still have not done that with care work. It's still not part of the way we conceptualize what we mean and must mean by essential work.
Absolutely. And again, going back to how schools are going to be operating in this patchwork manner, is only going to elevate how much we rely on childcare. And if daycares reopen, some daycares have reopened already. Some are specifically for essential workers, so healthcare providers. Are we going to be able to have a childcare system that will be able to manage this 2 days in school and 3 days at home, but mom and dad still need to be able to go back to work, that sort of thing?
I mean, I think that that's such an important point, and I think that it's really interesting, first, that daycare centers across the nation are in a crisis. Many of them are closing at this moment because of the way they were structured. They can't afford to open in a safe way, right? They can't afford to open with half the kids, basically, right? And so daycares across the country, at the very moment that they're needed more than ever, are going under or are unable to figure out how to do this. And the reason, this is not inevitable. So I think that's just so important. This is not inevitable. The reason that this is happening is because we've privatized daycare. This should be a function of the state. This should be something the government is involved in. It should not be a profit-making venture, right? Which is what it essentially is, and which is why it's now collapsing under these conditions. This needs to be considered an essential service. This is essential as schooling, public schooling, and we have a network of that for the functioning of our society. And it's possible for that still to happen. During World War II, overnight, practically, the government created daycare centers across the country because they wanted women to be in the labor force. And a whole network of daycare centers funded by the government came to being very, very quickly, and they were wildly popular by the people who used them. We have the capacity, we just don't have the will to do this.
Oh yeah, I'm often talking about that mode of childcare that happened during World War II. we've done it before, we can do it again, we just have to have the will. So one of the things I really want to say is this: thank you for many of these chapters and connecting these issues that are not always thought of as feminist issues, and highlighting the activists who were doing the work, particularly the chapter on environmentalism and labor. The way you weave those two things into a feminist framework was just like, mwah. particularly when you covered Anjan Poo, and she declares, we were all feminists, and feminism, and she muses on the idea that feminism could be a broad umbrella. And I think of feminism as a broad umbrella, but it doesn't always operate in that manner. Did you feel like this was a common theme with the people you talked with? And was this a common theme around the people you talked with?
I mean, I think a common theme was what the media has portrayed to be feminism is not my feminism, right? A common theme is what the media calls feminism, which is either dead, as we've talked about, or white women in organizations like the National Organization for Women campaigning for equal pay, let's say, right? That's not my feminism. I have a very different understanding of feminism, but that media portrayal or the popular portrayal sometimes is so toxic that people don't even want to use the label for themselves because they're worried they will be misinterpreted as espousing or endorsing those other kinds of politics that is not really what their own work is about. So I think people have even those of us who embrace the identity or will call ourselves feminists, it's always tricky because we know that label is used by so many different people in so many different ways. I feel that it's vitally important for people to reclaim it, right? And because otherwise we're letting the work of a few define a whole movement, right? In a way that just doesn't make sense. But that part of the reason that it's not always portrayed as a broad umbrella that it really is.
One of the things that comes out in a number of the chapters is this idea that the professionalization of feminism depoliticizes it. And I think that that's also connected to how we get different definitions of feminism or different views of feminism. So this, and it could even bring us to what Andy Zeisler calls marketplace feminism. So I'd love to hear your thoughts on, is the risk of professionalizing feminism always the depoliticizing of it?
I think that that's a great point. And so I think that, I mean, Ajahn is a perfect example. She's a professional feminist, right? She makes her money from doing her work with the domestic workers, from giving lectures, she is a professional feminist. Is she not radical? Oh my gosh, right? I mean, she is incredibly radical and brilliant, and the things she says about care work are, you know, have really transformed so much of what we think of when we think about domestic laborers. And so I think that have there been times in her life when, because of the place that she was getting her funding from, she may have had to choose her words carefully, or because of the way the network of funders who were giving her money to do a certain kind of work, she maybe had to prioritize some kinds of work more than others that she felt were equally important. People, these are the kinds of choices that feminists who are doing this work are forced to make all the time. But But there's no perfect solution to this problem, right? The other thing would be for us to go out and get jobs doing something completely different, right? For nonprofits and philanthropists to stop giving their money to these causes. And so what I found is the majority of feminists who were kind of faced with these issues in the 90s, and I think still today, you know, it was like, okay, there's no perfect road. This is, I'm going to do the best I can in these constraints. We're always going to have constraints, and I'm going to do the best I can to take down the system that is supporting me, you know, or whatever, like this kind of thing. And so, you know, to critique the larger capitalist system, even as I'm working in it. And, you know, even the people who were devising the most radical critiques of the nonprofit industrial complex, an idea that came about in the 90s, even Insight, right? They were really pioneers in a feminist critique of professionalization. They weren't all saying we need not to do this work. They were saying we need, it just requires keen analysis, a keen awareness of the compromises we're making, sometimes an ability to say no, like I'm not willing to go there. That doesn't mean you do everything someone who's giving you money is going to say, but that we have to find a way to do our work within capitalism.
Absolutely.
Not everybody believed that, but most did.
Yeah, I really appreciated that section on Insight and that critique of the critique almost.
Yeah, exactly.
So yeah. Some people had just read the title of their book and some people actually engaged with the content of the book.
Yeah, that's a great point.
So let's talk about Hillary Clinton real quick. We started with her. Let's almost wrap up with her. Her role in the Beijing conference was overshadowing of a lot of people's work. But her role in mainstreaming feminism in the 90s shouldn't be understated as well. How do you see her? How do you balance her role in feminism from the 90s on?
Such an important issue. Some little context. When the Beijing conference came about, plans for it came about, Hillary Clinton was kind of in the midst of an epic public failure. She had been put in charge of overhauling our healthcare system by President Clinton. President Clinton, and she had come up with this plan that basically it was, you know, I think thousands of pages long. It was this huge plan, incredibly complicated, and basically pleased nobody. And almost in trying to please everyone, she ended up pleasing no one. They got very little support for it. It was basically a huge failure of the first term of Clinton's first term, and she was responsible for that failure. So she, feminism and like women's issues became for her like another lane to go on, right? After this epic failure she had experienced in the US. And so she saw the Beijing conference as kind of an opportunity to present a different image of herself, to start exploring a new lane. And in preparation for the conference, she and her daughter, Chelsea, went on a tour of Southeast Asia. And they met with all kinds of women's groups who were doing various kinds of work to make their communities better places to live. And they learned a lot about the kinds of frameworks that they were thinking about. And they also networked with women's organizations in the US who were working internationally. And through that kind of research that she did in preparation for the conference, which included a vetting of her speech by many prominent feminists in the US, she learned the slogan, women's rights are human rights, which was a slogan that had been actually originated in the Philippines and had been used by people, feminists working internationally at the United Nations and beyond to try to change global and local policy. And so she learned that that's the kind of framework that many people in this arena were working in. But when she used it in her speech, many people who heard it didn't understand this longer history that she was drawing on, this larger trajectory of feminist labor from the global South and beyond that she was echoing. And I know I, for example, thought that was her, that was her idea, that she had invented that slogan, which turns out not at all to be the case. And I think some people today still think of her as the person who came up with those words. So it's a complicated history. Some of the people involved in that work were grateful to Hillary Clinton for bringing that issue to light. She had a kind of, one of them said, she became our megaphone, right? She took our ideas and she had a megaphone that we didn't have. Others really felt that she had co-opted their work and had taken credit for something that she didn't herself invent.
Yeah, yeah. I also, you know, as I said, Beijing was during my undergrad year, so I actually know history of international women's work other than what was in my class. So I did, I will say, as somebody who has taken plenty of women's studies classes and reads women's history, feminist history for fun, I did learn a lot in your book. So thank you.
Oh, well, you, I mean, we didn't talk, I know that we're supposed to be wrapping up, but I would just like to give a little preview of the fact that we didn't talk about the two chapters and that really feature a lot of the incredible work that you did in pioneering one of the most central shifts of this decade, which was the rise of online feminist activism. Uh-huh. And so maybe another time we can talk about web rings and such things.
We can definitely do that. Actually, I was thinking about, we were going to wrap my recording up and then we can shift into your own. You can ask me some questions.
That sounds fantastic.
Okay. So this podcast is called The Feminist Agenda. And part of it is because I am obsessed with organizing myself and organizing my life. I like pens. I like journals. I'm a bullet journaler. So how do you stay organized?
That's such a great question. About the problem, this is my problem. I have maybe 30 different systems that all go at once. So
you've been there, been there.
Yes, I think I probably need to pare it down. So I have Asana, I have Todoist, I have emailing myself, I have Google Calendar reminders. You name it, I've tried it. Many of them I continue to try and I continue to have them all going at the same time. I probably should narrow it down to just one system, but right now it's probably about 6 or 7 going.
I've definitely been there, which is one of the reasons why I became a evangelist of bullet journaling, because it's definitely not my only system, but it has, I think, become my base. And then things move up to Google Calendar, emailing myself, sticky notes. My work, my office, we use Asana off and on. Since we've been home working, we've been using Slack a lot, actually, to keep track.
I fear the day that will happen to me, because it seems such a distraction.
So it's a good way to touch base with people, as opposed to, we're pretty good at moderating ourselves and not spending a lot of time chatting with each other. Anyway, thank you so much for this time. Thank you so much for finding me and including me in this history.
Oh, well, thank you for participating. My interviews were by far the most rewarding and inspiring part of the work, and talking with you was a real highlight.
Thanks.
Okay, now that was a fun conversation. There is a second part to this conversation where Lisa asks me questions. I will put it up soon. But it's been hilarious trying to put it together because we went off script so often. And before we get to that episode, I have at least one, maybe two, other feminists to introduce you to. So, first, thanks to Lisa for being on The Feminist Agenda, and I look forward to our second episode. Until then, A reminder that you can find the Feminist Agenda on all your usual social media spots, Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at FeministaCast. That's Feminist A, Cast. You can also email me at FeministCast@gmail.com. That's Feminist, no A, Cast@gmail.com. So until next time, keep feminism on your agenda and wear your mask.